From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, big changes are on the way for virtually all of GM's cars and trucks.
There's nothing more important in the market today or for years now than brand new product on the lot.
Plus, is the gradual economic recovery in Michigan helping nonprofits as they set their fundraising goals?
Takeaway for the nonprofit leaders is if they're looking for a whole lot more economic recovery to just kind of float their boat to higher levels of giving, that may not be a realistic expectation.
And everybody, warm up those crazy flipper fingers for the Michigan Pinball Expo.
Pinball is basically like learning a new course in golf or a new rule set in poker. It's not just checkers, it's chess.
Those stories and much more ahead today on Stateside. But first, two important and controversial laws took effect this week in Michigan. Laws that were passed in the blizzard of activity by the lame duck legislature last December. One law concerns medical marijuana, the other concerns abortion. Joining us to explain the ins and outs of these two new laws are Chris Gouts. He's the Capitol correspondent for Crane's Detroit Business. Welcome back, Chris.
Thank you. Great to be back.
And Chad Livengood, the Lansing reporter for the Detroit News, joins us. Hey, Chad.
Thanks for having me today.
Let's start with that new law affecting abortions in Michigan. Chad, just what is in the new law?
The new law on abortions is requiring clinics to be licensed as freestanding surgical centers. And this is going to probably test some of these clinics about whether they're going to be able to remain in business, because there's several different regulations that are going to be involved here. Some of these clinics could be end up being closed because they don't have wide enough hallways. And so they're going to have to comply with these new regulations. At the same time, there's some new regulations for disposal of fetal remains. And that kind of came after a lot of anti-abortion advocates were concerned about the way the remains were being disposed. There was a case in Delta Township in Eaton County in which there was found to be some fetal remains in a dumpster. So there was a couple different elements to this law to try to further regulate abortion clinics.
And there's also going into whether or not a woman is being coerced, correct?
That's correct. Yeah, they're going to be scanning or at least asking several different types of questions about whether the woman has been forced or coerced to come and get this abortion.
So, Chris Gouts, who was for and who was against this law and why?
Well, it was largely Republicans as well as a few Democrats in more conservative leaning districts. And like Chad said, part of it had to do with Senator Rick Jones talking about that issue with the fetal remains that were put in the dumpster. That's what he said sort of spurred him on into doing this. And his point is that whether or not you're going in to get an abortion or getting, you know, plastic surgery done, you should be in a safe, sterile environment that's regulated and inspected by the state, because he doesn't want women to go somewhere to get an abortion and to, you know, possibly get infected or have something, you know, be in a place that's not up to standards. Of course, the opponents of that are saying that this is just a real backhanded way to try to make abortions as less frequent as possible in Michigan. And you can argue whether or not that's true, because there are some cases, like Chad said, in maybe some of the more rural counties where they're not going to be able to meet some of the standards. Although Planned Parenthood, which operates four centers in Michigan, two of those are already surgical centers. One doesn't need to be, because all it does is administer a pill. Mm. And the fourth one in Flint that is going to be applying for that. And they don't foresee any problems meeting those standards.
I have to ask you, has that story out of Delta Township about the fetal remains, has that actually been proven to be true?
I believe the state did investigate that, and by all, there is disputed accounts there about whether that was really the case. But the state did investigate, and they determined there was no law against it, essentially. And so...
Until now.
until now, yes. Yeah. And this has happened about 5 years ago, so this has been an issue that's been debated by the legislature in the past, ever since then, basically.
And I want to add one other thing with the coercion piece. There is a sort of a real gaping loophole in this law, in that while women have to be counseled on coercion issues, the legislature never actually got around to making coercion an illegal activity. But they did make these abortion clinics post in their offices that coercion is illegal.
But basically, it's not because there's no law.
Right. So right now, Michigan lawmakers are requiring abortion clinics to post a falsehood in their office because it is not illegal. They have to tell them that it's illegal, but it's actually not illegal. And I've been talking with some folks this week, and they said that they do realize now that they kind of messed that up and it kind of got lost in the sausage-making process of legislation. So they're actually going to try to go back when they come back from spring break next week in the next couple months, try to add that into a bill and get that into it so that it is, in fact, illegal. And as part of that, when that debate all happened, that the Democrats actually tried some what's good for the goose, good for the gander amendments, and they actually tried to put it on an amendment that would force doctors that are treating pregnant women to ask whether or not they were being forced or coerced into keeping the baby. They thought that should be applied, the same overall. It's really truly about coercion and women's safety, and the Republicans shot that.
Yeah, one thing to note that this law, these regulations only apply to abortion clinics that provide surgical abortions. If it's a clinic that provides oral medication or the abortion pill, they don't have to be a surgical center.
So, can we expect to see more abortion legislation being considered by the legislature? Obviously, that loophole is going to be taken up. Is there anything else we should watch for in this issue?
Well, this legislation originally had, it was part of a kind of an omnibus large bill, and there was a couple different bills. They originally had a ban on abortion after 20 weeks, but the legislature ended up dropping that over in the House fairly early on in the process. You might recall, This is the bill that sparked the heated debate in June on the floor of the House, in which former State Representative Lisa Brown invoked her female anatomy while on the floor, and then the next day she wasn't allowed to speak, and that brought a huge rebuke against the Republican leadership for banning her from speaking for a day. And so this bill has brought a lot of other side stories and controversies, and this whole argument from the Democrats that it's a war on women. So it may be that after they got this done, that the Republican legislature is going to try to be careful not to open this Pandora's box too many more times than they have to.
Let's go over to medical marijuana now. Keeping in mind, there are more than 131,000 registered medical marijuana users in Michigan and another 27,000 who are caregivers, which means people who can grow marijuana for up to 5 people. So, Chris, what does this new law do?
Well, it does a number of different things. It gets rid of this idea with sort of these doctor mills where a doctor would rent a hotel room or be at some sort of convention center with a bunch of growers, and people could just go there, sit down, or maybe go over on Skype and tell them they've got glaucoma, and then, boom, they've got their medical marijuana card. Now you actually have to have a bona fide doctor-patient relationship. You have to go and sit with the doctor. I think you have to get an exam. They have to keep medical records on you and follow up with you just like you would if they prescribed any other type of medication. They wouldn't just give you a carte blanche, card to get Vicodin for the rest of your life and then never see you again. So
that's
one of the things. They also made the state ID cards that allow you to get marijuana. Those are good now for 2 years rather than one, because there was a big problem because so many people applied and the state could not keep up. They actually had to purchase a new printer because they just couldn't make the cards fast enough. People were waiting months upon months to get their cards, and then by the time they got them, they'd have to reapply again. So that was another thing. And then one of the issues that they cleaned up that seems sort of common sense, but and I actually experienced this in my own community where now the police are allowed to, under these changes, if someone, they're allowed to call the state and ask if somebody's on the registry. So before they might have got a tip and from neighbors and said, hey, I see some people driving up and we think they might be growing marijuana or there might be some drugs going on there. Before, the police weren't allowed to call up the state, the LARA agency, and say, hey, we're going to go knock down this guy's door. Could you just check for us first to see if they're allowed to be doing what they're doing? And they weren't allowed, and the state couldn't tell them.
Huh.
So they cleaned that up. So
okay.
That's one of the things that should hopefully save some repair bills and some,
Hopefully there'll be a few less kicked in doors, in around the state. There's a couple other issues that still linger here with this law, in that only the caregiver can or the registered patient can grow the marijuana. We've had court rulings now that say that dispensaries, which popped up by the dozens after this law was passed in 2008, dispensaries are illegal or not permitted under these, or mass distribution of medical marijuana is not permitted. So that's an issue that's still out there in the legislature right now. They're talking about, you know, if we're going to have, if we're going to treat marijuana as a medicine, we ought to have some type of a regulated quality control. And so that's another topic that's still being debated in Lansing.
And as far as wanting these reforms, this was kind of bipartisan, wasn't it, Chad?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I mean, the legislation was sponsored by a couple Republicans and one Democrat, and in particular, Representative John Walsh, the Speaker pro tem from Livonia. He was a leader in getting this through the Judiciary Committee, he kind of partnered up with Democrat Phil Kavanaugh from Redford Township to make this come to fruition. And I think that they're going to come back, and another representative from outstate, Mike Calton from Nashville.
Yeah.
He's the one who is trying to get the dispensaries legalized. And it's kind of, you wouldn't think that a Republican from rural central Michigan would be pushing this, but more and more people are kind of starting to see that there is some well-known medical benefits to marijuana use in certain prescriptions.
Chris Goetz, Capital Correspondent for Crain's Detroit Business, and Chad Livengood, the Lansing reporter for the Detroit News. Always good to talk with both of you. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Calling all pinball fans. The Michigan Pinball Expo is coming to Oakland University this week. We'll talk with the organizer and longtime pinball player about what is in store for Michigan's pinball wizards. That story comes up in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It has certainly been a challenging few years for nonprofit groups in Michigan. Whether they depended on private donations or corporate donations or both, the Great Recession really hit organizations all over the state. But as our state gradually recovers, so are the nonprofits, especially in certain areas of Michigan. Montgomery Consulting is out with a new survey of fundraising conditions in Michigan. So who's on the rebound and who's still struggling? Michael Montgomery joins us now from Dearborn. So, Michael, what time frame does your survey address?
Well, we were in the field gathering information the second half of January and the first half of February. But we were also asking questions, recall questions, about how organizations did last year. So we asked them to evaluate current conditions, tell us about what they expect for this year, and then also tell us about last year, whether they made their goal, whether they felt last year they did better in 2012 than they had done in 2011.
So looking at Michigan's regions then, Michael Montgomery, where would you say the nonprofits doing the best in terms of meeting their fundraising goals are located?
Well, it's West and Southwest Michigan. Across the state, about 60% of organizations reported that they'd met their 2012 fundraising goals. But in West and Southwest Michigan, that rises to 75%.
And why do you think that is?
Well, I think they're a little ahead of the rest of the state in terms of economic recovery.
So that obviously, as that's going on, the perception is from donors is we can loosen it up a little bit and give more.
Yep, and that also carries over into how the fundraisers and nonprofit leaders saw their local fundraising climate. Not only were the organizations in that area most likely to have met their goal last year, they report that they evaluate current conditions for fundraising more highly than do organizations in other parts of the state.
So West and Southwest, they're pretty well smiling when they're putting their annual reports together and saying in terms of meeting their fundraising goals. Who's struggling?
Well, in terms of Central and some area Michigan organizations, they only 59% of them met their goals. And in Metro Detroit, the average dropped down to 53% met their goals last year. In terms of how they look at local fundraising conditions at the current time, some area Michigan organizations were the least enthusiastic. 50% of them said current conditions were good, and 40% said they were not so good. All of the others had majorities saying that conditions were good or excellent, and very small percentages saying not so good. So really, in central Michigan on up through the Thumb area, that's where organizations were really the least upbeat about their fundraising results last year and their fundraising conditions early this year.
Is it a Flint-Saginaw type of effect? Or
It's Flint-Saginaw. I think it's also the agency serving small towns where they were very dependent on some of the very smallest auto suppliers, the guys that are most likely to be completely out of the new way of doing business.
When the whole strip down had to happen. So what is the takeaway of your research, do you think, Michael Montgomery, for not only the folks who run nonprofits in Michigan, but the people who depend on their services?
Well, I think that what we're looking at is a system where recovery's real, but it's slow. The vast majority expected fundraising this year will be at least as good as last year, 91.5%, but half said they expect it only to be as good as 2012. So a takeaway for the nonprofit leaders is probably if they're looking for a whole lot more economic recovery to just kind of float their boat to higher levels of giving, that may not be a realistic expectation. They may need to change how they do business, how they fundraise, or how they conduct their business to increase revenues or reduce expenses. In terms of the individuals, I think people need to be conscious that this is a system that there's reasons for optimism, but there's also, it's going to continue to be a system under some degree of stress. It's really a mixed outlook for fundraising at the current time.
Montgomery Consulting with the results of its second annual Michigan Fundraising Conditions Survey. This, by the way, is the only regularly scheduled survey that looks and focuses in on fundraising by Michigan nonprofit organizations. And we've been talking with Michael Montgomery. Thanks so much, Michael.
Well, thank you.
Even as Mother Nature plays her own little cat and mouse game with us regarding whether or not spring has actually arrived, there is one unimpeachable source telling us that despite the chilly temps and despite the snow showers, spring is here. The birds. No doubt you've heard the welcome sounds of birds chirping in the mornings. That harbinger of warmer weather to come got us wondering, what's the state of Michigan birds? Late last month, some of the state's top conservationists, biologists, and professors came together for a statewide Michigan Bird Conference. The co-chair of this Michigan Bird Conservation Initiative workshop is Kara Haas. Kara is with the Kellogg Bird Sanctuary in Augusta, near Battle Creek. Her mission is all about protecting and restoring bird populations and their habitats in Michigan. Kara Haas joins us now from Augusta. Kara, what success stories can you celebrate in terms of conservation or restoration of bird populations or their habitats?
So something that we're tentatively celebrating or looking forward to is the possible delisting of the Kirtland's warbler, which would mean taking it off of the endangered species list. So Kirtland's warbler is a tiny little yellow bird that has very specific nesting wants, and it uses the young jack pine forest that we have up near like Oscoda County, Michigan, and it's a species that needs human management to survive because its habitat was always controlled by forest fire to regenerate those forests, but now with so many humans around, we have to suppress forest fires so we don't have any tragedies or total loss of property. So we have to manage for this species. So something we are talking about is if the Kirtland's warbler is taken off of the endangered species list, its habitat will still need to be managed so that it is so that it survives and it doesn't fall back into decline. And so the Kirtland's Warbler Initiative is being led by Huron Pines. And they're doing a large capital campaign to raise funds to create a plan to do management long-term for that species so that it'll still be here in the Michigan landscape.
Is that because if they're taken off the endangered species list, funding is lost?
Yes.
Okay, so it's a mixed blessing to have them off the endangered species list then.
Yes, it is. So, we're trying to be ahead of the game and have plans in place so that we don't take any steps back.
What species are most threatened, Kara, as you kind of look at the Michigan bird population?
The research from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, they put out a State of the Birds report every year, and species that use grassland habitat are ones that are doing very poorly, and species that use shorelines. Mm. So any bird that's tied to the water. And a lot of that is just tied to loss of habitat.
We're speaking with Kara Haas, who is with the Kellogg Bird Sanctuary in Augusta, near Battle Creek, about the state of the Michigan bird. And could you give us, from your perspective as a conservationist, Kara, tell us why it is so important to protect endangered birds? In other words, how would Michigan's ecological system be harmed if we lose a species or two? I mean, isn't that just biology, and has that not gone on over the eons?
Sure. We're kind of at, birds in biodiversity in any ecosystem is of the utmost importance. So having the most native species working together in the ecological community is what makes that community healthy and functioning. So it's like when you're putting together a puzzle. If you're missing all the straight pieces that go on the edge, it's not easy to put together, and it's just not working.
Okay.
And, doesn't make a pretty picture. And so losing a few birds out of an ecosystem could mean that there's a food source in there that goes totally out of whack. Maybe you lose a hawk, which is a predator bird, and then your rodent population skyrockets. And then because you have so many rodents, they eat all the seeds, and then there's no flowers to grow because all the seeds got eaten. So every organism within an ecosystem is important. And birds are often on the highest level. The loss of the bird could have a deeper impact because they're such an important species.
Kara Haas is with the Kellogg Bird Sanctuary in Augusta near Battle Creek. Thanks so much for talking with us today on Stateside, Kara.
You're welcome.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Who's Pinball Wizard was an anthem for the baby boom generation who grew up going to arcades where dozens of pinball machines would be lined up. And in these days of Xbox and PS2, yes, there are still pinball wizards of all ages.
Ever since I was a young boy, I played the silver ball. From Soho down to Brighton, I must have played them all. But I ain't seen nothing like him in any amusement hall. That deaf, dumb, and blind kid sure plays a mean pinball.
The Michigan Pinball Expo is coming to Oakland University this week. And joining me now is organizer and longtime pinball player, John Cosmo. Welcome to Stateside, John.
Thank you for having me.
So you have been a pinball player since you were 9. You came in second at the Pinball World Championship in 2007. You are married to a fellow pinball enthusiast. What is it that a player gets from playing pinball that just can't happen, let's say, if you're sitting, there with your Xbox?
Pinball's kind of more like a real, it's a three-dimensional device. You're not escaping into a false world. You're playing and you're still in the real world. The ball's real. The things that you're doing are real. The eye-hand coordination, the geometry. Every pinball machine is basically like a new poker game, where in poker you have a few dozen different poker games to learn. Pinball is basically like learning a new course in golf or a new rule set in poker. It's not just checkers, it's chess. There's just a lot of strategy and a lot of skill involved.
And, of course, you can just appreciate aesthetically the art and the design and the sounds and the music of each machine, because each one really does take you on a different trip, doesn't it?
Absolutely, and I mean that's basically what it is. Each pinball machine has a traditional back glass, and that's kind of like the billboard. And you know, when you're walking through the arcade and you're walking down Arcade Highway, and you look and you see a billboard for, you know, whether it's Avengers or Wizard of Oz or what have you, you know, you're going to walk up to whatever machine interests you and where your interests lie. So yeah, that's a big part of it. Absolutely, is, you know, the artwork and, you know, what themes they pick.
So what's going to happen at the Michigan Pinball Expo over these 4 days?
Wow, there's going to be a lot happening. We're giving away over $20,000 in cash and prizes. We're giving away, courtesy of Able Electronics and Gary Monarch and Jersey Jack Pinball, a brand-new Hobbit LE pinball machine, which isn't even built yet. It'll be built, you know, corresponding with the three movies coming out, The Hobbit. And we have just tournaments for every skill level, every age, every gender. We have the Women's Michigan Pinball Championships. We have the Pinball Wizards Pinball Championship for Michigan. We have all our wizard and training tournaments for children on Saturday. And we have even the novice division. So if you've never even played before, you can walk up and still have a chance to win a few $100 playing pinball. We also have vendors that are going to be buying and selling pinball machines. So if you play something that you like, you know, there's probably going to be a price tag on almost everything, and it's for sale. And if you want to take it home, give that opportunity. And then we also have speakers where we're going to have Jersey Jack from Jersey Jack Pinball, who just made The Wizard of Oz. He'll be speaking at our show. And we'll have some past designers and artists and people that can actually tell you how to fix and maintain your own pinball machine.
And am I correct that you pay at the door, and then there are dozens and dozens of machines that are there to be played as much as you want?
Absolutely. There's no quarters involved here. So unlike a traditional arcade where you walk in and you start dropping quarters on what you want to play,
sure,
you pay a low fee, which at the door would be $15 for kids, $20 for adults, and you can play from 8 in the morning till 12 midnight, and there's no quarters. So every machine will be, you know, at your beck and call, that if you want to just walk up and start playing, you just hit start and you're good to go. And we'll have over 125 pinball machines this year, probably approaching 150, as I'm giving calls every day from people wanting to bring games.
I'm talking with John Cosmo, who's the organizer of the big Michigan Pinball Expo happening coming up at Oakland University this week. And I kind of think, John, as I think back, that the kids who listened to The Who's Tommy in 1969 and, you know, got hooked on Pinball Wizard are literally grandparents today. Do you see a lot of cross-generational action at the Pinball Expo?
Oh, it's huge. Well, pinball's been around since the 1800s. It used to be called Bagatelle, and then they started having bingo machines where you can nudge the machines and get them to fall in certain holes. And then in 1947, Humpty Dumpty came down the line at Gottlieb, and it had six flippers. Flippers were first introduced at that time.
Hmm.
And ever since 47. So, I mean, you can imagine being a teenager in 47, you know, that covers a wide range from being a teenager in 47 to being a teenager in 2013. So everybody pretty much on the planet has seen or played or been around, you know, while pinball's been out and about. There's just tons of great things about it, and it crosses all ages and all genders. It's just a fun, family-friendly game that just is a lot of good times.
And this is a very family-friendly expo.
It's super family-friendly. You know, we have stools there for kids, so if you have kids that are, you know, sub 3 foot tall, they can hop up on a stool and play a game. You know, we have everyone from grandchildren to grandparents there. Actually, a quick story, parents bring their kids to go up and play, and the kids are all like, kind of like, you know, we don't want to do this, blah, blah, blah. They come down like 3 or 4 hours later, and the kids are kicking and screaming that they don't want to leave. And then a couple hours later, we'll see the same parents back. We'll be like, hey, weren't you just here? Like, yeah, we want to take our kids back home. We left them with the sitter. Now we want to have some time to play ourselves.
For someone who's never played pinball, John, can you give us a sense and describe what it's like to really be in the moment and really have a great pinball session?
It's really like when you get in the zone in pinball, you really feel like you're the luckiest person on the planet, because you just feel like the ball's never going to go out. You're hitting every shot you want to hit. You're maximizing your scores. You're maximizing your bonus. The machine's just doing everything that it was programmed to do, and you're making it happen just based off skill with your eye-hand coordination and just, you know, having a great time doing it. You know, when you get these games teed up and maxed out for everything that they're worth, I mean, it's a great light show. The programmers do a great job with the choreography, connecting whatever game it is you're playing with the playing experience. So if you're playing Avengers or Wizard of Oz, you feel like you're walking down the yellow brick road. You feel like you're in the tornado. You feel like the witch is chasing you. They do a great job at, you know, helping you sink into these games, and every game's like its own little universe. So if you're playing one of these themed games, you feel like you're part of the story, whether it's Lord of the Rings, Avengers, Batman, Spider-Man, you feel like you're there, and it's a great escape.
The Michigan Pinball Expo runs from April 4th through the 7th at Oakland University, and you can get all the details at their website. It's mipinball.com. That's mipinball.com. And we've been talking with organizer John Cosmo. Thanks so much, John.
Thank you for having me. We really appreciate you guys covering us.
Coming up next, GM's North America chief financial officer promises the company will restyle their vehicles. We talk with two leading auto analysts to learn what this really means for consumers and for GM. This is Stateside on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, General Motors says the car and truck buying public will be seeing changes in the next few years whenever we walk into a GM showroom. GM's North America Chief Financial Officer Chuck Stevens recently told analysts that the automaker will redesign, refresh, or replace nearly 90% of its vehicles in the North American market between now and 2016. So we wondered, is this a matter of blazing new trails or playing catch up with the competition? So we welcome to the program Sean McElinden, who is the Executive VP of Research and the Chief Economist at the Center for Automotive Research. He joins us in the studio. Welcome back, Sean.
Oh, thanks.
And joining us from Boston is independent auto analyst John Wolkonowicz. Hi, John.
Good to be with you today.
Good to have you with us. Sean, I want to start with you. Tell me of what you thought of that announcement from Chuck Stevens. Is it significant or is it window dressing?
No, it's significant. It's about time, too. They've been obviously behind the market. Their product's a little older than the other companies. There was a big slowdown in 2008, 2009 for obvious reasons. They weren't traveling too fast before that either. And really, to compete these days, what the customer wants to see on the dealership lot is a car that's no more than 2.5 years since its last major redesign, 2 years old. So GM's been over four, and Ford's been doing well, and so are the other auto companies. And I think this is an excellent development. It's mostly catch up, but it's really good news for GM.
So for dealers that have been looking at trying to sell product that's really literally long in the tooth, I'm sure the dealers are really celebrating this news then.
Oh, yeah. The new product is everything at Capture. Something new to show, something new to put in the paper, something new to send, emails out to old customers or even new ones. That's what it's all about. There's nothing more important in the market today or for years now than brand new product on the lot. So, and, you know, there's something else happening, too. We have some really tough fuel economy regulations to meet in 2016, and GM's also making a push with their last surge of models in the next 3 or 4 years to get that higher fuel economy product on the market.
Yeah, I want to make sure we touch on that. Yeah. Before we do, I want to ask you, John Wolkonowicz, when we hear Chuck Stevens say redesign, refresh, or replace, what does that really mean? Because it occurs to me a refresh could be something like a different look to a door handle, couldn't it, which would not be very big news to a buyer. It might excite an engineer, but perhaps not so much for the buyers.
Yeah, it can be something pretty small as a refresh. And so from my perspective, yeah, they are playing a bit of catch-up, but this is kind of normal for any auto company to make an announcement like this, that they're always going to be doing something to 90% of their product over the next few years. So I'm not getting too excited about this. And the other thing that I think we need to look at is how effective will this new product be in the marketplace? You got to be new. That's important. But you also have to hit consumer wants and needs as you're new. Now, I can give you an example where GM didn't do that with the 2013 Malibu. They had a real hit on their hands with the 08 Malibu, which was a very successful product. But the 2013, while it was all new, really did not hit consumers the way they hoped it would. And they have a large day's supply. They shut the plant down that makes it for a while. and they're offering money back already on what is a new product. They're really getting killed by the competition. So being new isn't enough. You have to be exactly what the customer wants as well.
Do you think it's was it the changes in the Malibu that didn't hit, or was it because Ford came out with that Fusion that people really, really like, so there was a real serious contender?
It was a little bit of both. I mean, the competition in the midsize segment is huge right now. With Fusion, with Elantra, with Optima, even with Volkswagen resurging. But the 2013 Malibu simply wasn't what it needed to be. It's a very lackluster product.
So that was a swing and a miss.
Yeah.
Well, there's no question about that. They're not the only company that's missed at the plate. The Honda Civic a couple of years ago, or even less than that, got scathing reviews from critics. And,
that's right.
It forced Honda to go back to sort of a major reskin and redo of the interior. Even the Honda Accord they had on the market 3 years ago was thought to be way too large for that company and for the market. And, of course, their new Accord is a beautiful trendsetter. But they went back to the drawing board very early, and I think expect General Motors to do the same thing on the Malibu, which is, of course, in the toughest segment in the U.S. market, which is midsize sedan, and also the hottest segment in the market.
Well, they said they're going to do a front-end refresh and some changes to the interior to make it appear more roomy, but one thing they can't overcome is that short 107-inch wheelbase, which is down from 112 in the previous model, and they have one of the smallest rear seat packages in the segment. So I'm afraid they're going to be stuck with that for a while.
Boy, and that rear seat, that can make it or break it. Just, I know, speaking as a buyer, when you know that you've got kids or you've got a long-legged husband who might be in the back seat with a baby or whatever, that can really, really do you in.
Exactly. And, you know, I'm also concerned about the new Silverado and Sierra. They've announced some impressive fuel economy numbers, which is a great thing. But from a design standpoint, I think that was another hit and a miss. It almost looks like it's the truck that should have preceded the one that came out in 2007. It's a bland, boring design, and we've got Ford, who's already given us an inkling of what they're doing for 2015, but they'll be having a new truck a year after GM. And I'm actually very concerned about Silverado and Sierra, which are the number one profit makers at GM.
What do you think on that truck side, Sean?
It's very conservative on styling. There isn't any question on that. It looks like they've concentrated mostly on trying to preserve the traditional V8 motor for that particular pickup and giving a better performance in these fancy turbocharged six-cylinder editions. And they also took some weight out of the truck. Styling on a pickup truck is certainly part of the equation, but it's not as important sometimes, obviously, as the performance and the durability, which the Detroit automakers have been outstanding over the last 30 years and refused to give up any turf, except sometimes to each other.
Yeah.
No, and I agree with that, because one of the things that Mark Royce has said is, you know, we're going to do this with traditional V8s without having to go to the complication of a V6 turbocharged or twin turbo in the case of EcoBoost. So, you know, I think that is likely to appeal to truck buyers. So they do have a strong advantage there. They've got a traditional simple V8 compared to the complicated EcoBoost V6, and they've got better gas mileage to boot. But I have to ask, what will Ford do for an Encore in 2015? And they're likely to leapfrog GM's achievement.
If you're just joining us, we are talking with Sean McAlinden, who's with the Center for Automotive Research, and independent auto analyst John Wilkonowicz, who's joining us from Boston. Sean's here in the studio with us, kind of going over a recent announcement from General Motors North America CFO Chuck Stevens, telling the world that the automaker is going to be redesigning, refreshing, and replacing nearly 90% of its vehicles in the North American market between now and 2016. And Sean, you touched on this earlier. Let's get into this more. You kind of said it's a two-sided story in a way, because we're talking about design cues and changes, but as you pointed out, the government has set some real tough new fuel economy standards, and that means combined cars and trucks in 2016 in the U.S. and therefore North America are going to have to average 34.1 mpg, so that's up 35% from the current 25.3. So aren't they all going to have to refresh, design, or replace?
That's the point. The average replacement rate is probably 22-23% a year right now, and at GM at 25% in the next 4 years is going to have to they're really basically just a tiny bit above average. Chrysler will in a year's time, but had to delay it a bit, replace almost all of our car platforms with Fiat-based models and much smaller, more efficient motors as we try to get to that fuel economy average. And it remains to be seen whether it's going to be popular in the market. No one can guess what the gasoline price will be or what the final technology cost might be. And they're all going to, and what, you know, essentially we're going to see a lot of experimentation, I think, in this market. And that means a lot of changeover, a lot of new models, some lost downtime on plants, a real scramble by every automaker.
And then since you're the chief economist at Center for Automotive Research, I have to ask you, what kind of impact do you think this would have on the economy here in Michigan while all of this fluidity is going on?
Well, one thing that what's interesting, if the market keeps growing and if GM can hold, you know, with these new model changeovers, probably will hold share at least, not gain all that much. We're going to be running out of capacity fairly soon as the market approaches 16 million. Because we did restructure so severely in the last 10 years. So, you know, essentially the downtime for all of these changeovers, we're not as good at it as maybe the Japanese at how fast we can get it done. So we're really got every plant already running on three shifts over 6 days a week, running out of space for our most popular engines. We're going to have to add some employment and capacity soon.
What do you think, John?
I would agree with him definitely. They skimmed a lot of capacity off with the bankruptcy in 2009. So, you know, right now they're in a position to make a lot of money, but they may also find themselves short of capacity, having to give up some sales. But, you know, they weathered the return from bankruptcy very well. They are making profit quite handsomely right now. And in a way, that I think that's more important than getting that last sale. But one other mention on fuel economy, GM has been a powertrain leader throughout its history, and that really hasn't changed. So I think they certainly have the capability to be very competitive in the fuel economy wars that are coming up. They have some of the best powertrain engineers in the business at GM.
That's absolutely correct. And in fact, what's interesting, the EPA recently announced a rule about much lower sulfur content gasoline by 2017. And actually, in GM's powertrain plans that we've seen is a heavy use of something called gasoline direct injection, particularly for that V8 engine, which can only operate with low sulfur fuel, like gasoline, like in Europe or Japan.
So they're out ahead of that parade.
As a matter of fact, here's a very rare example where the environmental movement, the EPA, and the auto industry are exactly on the same page.
There you go. What are you both going to be watching for from GM? I was wondering about your thoughts on the redesign, the Cadillac CTS for the midsize luxury sedan market, and then, of course, they have the ATS for the luxury compact sedan. What are your thoughts on those?
I think both are real winners. I think Cadillac really stepped up to the plate in revising the whole brand image back in 2002 when they introduced the original CTS with the so-called art and science design theme. They created a very unique design signature for the Cadillac brand, and that's something that's very important for a luxury brand. It needs to be immediately recognizable. And now, in the last 10 years, they've proven that they can evolve that design signature very effectively, such that now I think they have a very competitive lineup in the premium field. This is an area where Ford is still struggling with Lincoln.
Yeah, in fact, we know Ford's pouring enormous funding and resources into trying to make that Lincoln brand fresher and sexier. How do you see that working, Sean?
Well, GM just finishing a long, hard slog on Cadillac, which saw them stick with their own special platforms for that luxury brand and real drive cars. You know, special engines just for Cadillac. None of that's been given to Lincoln.
So
even yet.
Exactly.
And, you know, you're really serious about it or you aren't.
You can't have it both ways?
No, you can't. I mean, That kind of buyer is just too smart.
So you're saying is that kind of buyer is not going to pay premium prices for those Lincoln models that are basically dressed up Fords?
No, I drive a Lincoln, too. Mostly for the service.
And back to Cadillac, am I right? How's the SRX doing? Because I see them everywhere. Is it strong, or is it just because I'm noticing them everywhere?
That's the best-selling Cadillac from numbers I've seen. They're doing very well with that vehicle. And again, I think the Cadillac brand, they were very successful in lowering the average age. Cadillac 15 years ago had one of the highest average age of buyers in the industry. Today it's come down quite a bit, and it's something you can be proud of again to own a Cadillac. And again, I don't think Lincoln is there. As Sean said, basically they're doing warmed over Fords. They're still trying to resuscitate Lincoln on the cheap, and I just don't see it working. I really, unless they get very serious about Lincoln, I don't see that, at least the strategy they're currently pursuing, as a successful strategy.
Even though there was a lot of talk about, we're really, got rid of Mercury, let's pour it all into Lincoln. But
it appears to be a lot of talk, and it's business as usual in my mind.
Well, they had an LS rear-wheel drive platform 10 years ago. They had spent $5 billion on it in the 90s, and they just gave up on that car, the CEO Jack Nasser, and shelved it instead of fine-tuning it. And
exactly.
It really takes stick-to-itiveness in this market. With that special engineering, too, and much of it from powertrain, that just hadn't been given to Lincoln. That was a tragedy.
Let's shift gears back to GM to kind of wrap up. And I would like to get the thoughts of both of you, just what your forecast is for, GM for 2013 compared to, say, 2012. Sean?
Well, they're still not going to be making money in Europe. And they might, we're worried about maybe a slowdown in China, which has been offsetting most of the losses in Europe. Maybe 80% of them on the equity earnings. And I believe they'll hold market share and add a bit, whether they get to 19%. There is a debate within the GM building about that, is my understanding. So a lot of shouting about prices versus market share, what they need, how large they have to be. But I think they like that profit per unit, and we'll see a strong General Motors at about 19% of the market here.
And John Wilkonowicz?
The big problem is going to be Europe. They've been hemorrhaging there for a long time. I don't see that stopping for the foreseeable future. Again, with the new product in North America, I think they can certainly hold and maybe add a bit to their market share. And then, again, as he said, the slowdown in growth in China is going to impact a major profit center for GM. So I think the picture is reasonably positive.
And I guess, especially for people listening to Stateside, people who in Michigan who make their living through building cars or supplying parts to General Motors, do you have reason to feel fairly optimistic?
Yes, I do. And I think we will be adding to employment both in the supplier sector and at the company. Always good news for Michigan.
John Wilkonowicz, automotive analyst from Boston, joining us from Boston, and Sean McElinden from the Center for Automotive Research here in the studio. Thanks to both of you. It was really fun talking with you.
A lot of fun.
Bye.
And finally, we wish to offer heartiest congratulations to Geraldine Talley of Inkster. Geraldine has now become the oldest living American. She was born May 23rd, 1899. She is 113 years old. She drinks black coffee with a bit of sugar. She doesn't like cheese, and her motto is treat others the way you would want to be treated. She's the third oldest person in the world. According to the Gerontology Research Group, the world's two oldest people are both 115, and they live in Japan. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Today's show was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Bob Scon. Contributors are Allie Billings, Austin Davis, Maya Friedman, Emily Fox, and April Van Buren. This program's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.